And here comes Merle Code. Good, steady ball handler.
Senior out of Greenville, South Carolina. Fork Union Prep.
Code, who's an excellent off guard. Good defensive player. Code with the deflection.
There was a terrific steal by Code. He takes off.
Merle Code gets the rebound off the two missed shots. Code, nice penetration.
Good job by Code staying with him.
A steal from Merle Code.
He had his hand on a pass earlier in that possession, too. Came up with the steal that time.
Averages two a game. Fourth in the ACC in steals. And here's Code inside. The basket and the foul on Jeff Capel. Turbay finds Code underneath. This is Code.
What's up, everybody? Not My House is in the house. This is your host, Eric, and as always, right next to me is my co-host, Zach. Zach, what's going on this morning, my friend?
We got a very different episode today. I'm really excited for this one. Any friend of Gene's is a friend of ours, so I'm just really excited to have our guest here today.
Absolutely. He played his college basketball at Clemson. He played professionally in many different leagues. He's a former sneaker company rep for Nike and Adidas. It's a story that needs to be told in our opinion. Welcome to the show, Mr. Merle Code. How are you doing today, sir?
Good. Thank you guys for having me.
Absolutely. We always like to get to know our guests before we talk hoops. Why don't you give us a little background on where you're from and what it was like growing up there?
Sure. I'm originally from Greenville, South Carolina. A wonderful place to have grown up. Sports is a large part of the community. Obviously, being a South Carolina native, football is king. And so it was tough pickings for us as basketball players to be recognized as players back in the late 80s and early 90s. But we had a lot of talent come out of this area and guys who played high level in major college basketball. And so it was a wonderful time to grow up watching guys who did it before me that I idolized and wanted to be like.
Well, and I'm assuming your dad too, right? Because your dad was a great football player. Did you get pushed into playing football first, or was it Little League baseball, or was it basketball? What got the bug in sports for you?
Yeah, I think so. I come from a family of athletes. My grandmother, dad's mother, was a scholarship athlete at South Carolina State. My grandfather, my dad's father, was a scholarship athlete at Benedict College playing baseball. My mother was a high school letter winner in tennis. My dad, obviously, was a very good high school baseball player. Went on to play college football at North Carolina A&T, and they won a Black National College Championship. Had a hot cup of coffee in the NFL, but spent most of his time between the World League and the Canadian Football League. And so sports has been a large part of my family history, but education as well. And the trajectory of our families has really ascended because of our deep dive into the education realm as well as the sports realm.
Yeah, and when did you first fall in love with basketball? And I think it's always interesting to kind of hear from our guests who they used to watch, who they used to try to mimic. Like, who did you look at and want to play like? Like, who were some of your idols that you met?
Yeah, it was interesting because I had a really unique existence as a child. My mother is from Roanoke, Virginia. And my father is from Seneca, South Carolina, but we moved to Greenville, which was the big city from Seneca. Seneca's kind of a rural area, a small southern town. And so moving to Greenville and growing up in those days, you know, I watched guys like David Young, Eric Sullivan, Thomas Gray. I could go on and on and on about the guys that came from this area, who were really, really good players. Milt that went to Georgia was from here, went to Riverside High School. But then my summers I was spending in Roanoke, Virginia. And then I got to see and play against guys like Curtis Blair, who's now an NBA referee. George Lynch, you know, I think George played 15 years in NBA. Raymond and Damon Williams, who were the twins that I think still hold the all-time scoring record at VMI. Curtis Staples, grew up across the street from my grandmother. Troy Manns, one of my closest friends, was a point guard at George Mason and Virginia Tech. And all these guys lived in my grandmother's neighborhood. Some of their parents had gone to school with my mother in high school and, you know, elementary and middle school. So, you know, I was fortunate to have the best of both worlds in terms of seeing guys that I idolized in South Carolina. But then during the summers, getting the chance to see those guys that were in my grandmother's neighborhood and who were older, and go to camps, Cord Camp. I have to give a shout out to Cord Camp, because that's where I Coach Lovelace and Mickey Hardy, those guys were responsible for the love that I developed, I guess, around the age of 7 or 8.
Yeah, and you just mentioned some great names. Like, obviously, it's a very competitive area from where you're from. And, you know, give our listeners an idea of how you ranked with those players. Like, what kind of player are you? Just kind of what your high school career was like. Like, when did you realize that you're probably going to be a really good basketball player at the next level?
I can't say it during those days, you know, again, because my summers were sporadic in terms of the time frame. It just, you know, you're talking 6-7 weeks in Virginia, spending the majority of my time in South Carolina. And I thought I was a decent player. I could really shoot it, but I wasn't an athletic guy. You know, I wasn't jumping over the rim. But what I did have is a high basketball sense of time, of score, of possession. So I felt like my IQ was on a different level. So I saw things in anticipation before they happened. And so as I started to mature, my body started changing. I realized I had to be quicker with getting my shots off. I had to be more creative in terms of how I got my shots off, you know, running floaters, running the hooks, you know, kind of up and unders. Cause again, I wasn't jumping over anybody, and being a small guy who grew late, it helped me. So I think when I got to be a junior in high school, I started kind of realizing, you know, that I had a chance to play past high school. I didn't know what level, didn't have a lot to base it on. You know, we always think we're better than we really are. But getting a chance to play against those guys again that I so told you about during the summer was a good barometer that I knew I could play college basketball. I did not know what level, and was getting some interest from some junior colleges and some low to mid major D1s at the time. And then I had gone to BC. I don't know if you guys remember BC All-Stars. Do you guys remember BC All-Stars camps?
I've heard of it. I don't remember, but I've heard of it.
So they were they were a big deal in the South. And so again, man, because the South was not heavily regarded as a basketball landscape at that time, BC All-Stars was kind of the big deal for the kids between, you know, Virginia down to Florida and over across to Alabama. Right. So that was kind of the big deal. And it used to be held in Carnesville, Georgia, in like an old barn. And it was a bunch of, they just brought in some courts and, you know, you'd have all the high profile guys, you know, from Atlanta and in some of the big cities, again, Southern big cities, to come down. There'd be a few guys from the Midwest, a few guys from the North, but it was mainly a Southern kind of deal. And, you know, getting a chance to compete and play in that, again, realized I could play at a collegiate level. I was blessed and fortunate. A guy named Dan Peterson came to watch me play my senior year in high school and recommended that I go to Fork Union, which was a post-grad prep school. And it was military, so I wasn't all that thrilled about the possibilities, but I knew I didn't want to go to junior college because the rules were different at that time. You had to complete your degree. You had to go, if you were going to go, you had to go for 2 years. And so didn't want to lose 2 years of eligibility going to a junior college. So I ended up going to Fork Union and had a chance to learn under who I think was one of the best coaches of all time, and Fletcher Arrett. Passed away a few years ago, one of the best human beings on earth. And I learned floor spacing. You know, you learn how to move the ball, when to move the ball. You learn how to get the ball into the post, guys. He ran kind of a North Carolina type system. He and Dean Smith were good friends. And so I was very blessed to have a chance to play under his tutelage and learn from him. And it helped me mature. So when I stepped into college, I was ready to compete and play.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this is kind of where the conversation might be able to get a little bit interesting, just because, You know, you don't know what you know when you're in college, you know, and you're a kid and you're kind of deciding where you're going to go play and everything. And you just mentioned the BC camps, but I mean, you obviously also went through the recruiting process, like you just said. You end up playing 4 years at Clemson. You had some pretty high-profile teammates who went on to play in the NBA. And as a young man, what was the recruiting process like for you as far as your recruitment? Like, was your recruitment fairly normal or, you know, traditional? Like, do you have any wild recruiting trip stories? Like, were people offering money or anything illegal? Or how do you filter out what's right and what's wrong at that age?
I mean, you don't know what's right and what's wrong. And what people are telling you is wrong. Is wrong because they say it's wrong. Might not be necessarily wrong for you and your family situation, right? I was blessed and fortunate. I had come from a two-parent household. Mother and father both worked. And so I wasn't starving for my next meal. I wasn't worried about the lights being turned off or a roof over our head. That wasn't a lot of kids' situation. So it's hard when somebody's saying, hey, we want you to come play for us and we're willing to give you X amount of dollars. And you're saying, yeah, my mama needs that. My brothers and sisters need that because they're going to lose their house tomorrow. And then you want to punish a kid for doing what's right by his family because it's some rule that you made up. My recruiting process was fairly normal. I mean, I had some offers to put some monies into some accounts. I had some offers for vehicles. I did have some of those types of offers. Down the road, right? This is post, this is going prep school going into college.
Right.
But again, it wasn't a necessity for me. So that didn't turn me on, right? That wasn't something that I was kind of like, ooh, they offer me X amount of dollars. I'm going, because that wasn't my family's financial situation. So when some guys make those decisions based on the financial situations, I applaud them because they're doing what's best for them and their family. Because everybody's not going to play professionally. Everybody's not going to play in the NBA and make millions of dollars. So if they have a chance to give their family a leg up, by all means, fuck the rules, excuse my language. Do what's best for you and your family at the time. And so, when I got to college, it was certainly eye-opening because I saw it at a different level. The numbers that I was offered paled in comparison to what I saw some of my teammates having access to. I'll say it that way.
Right. Yeah, no, for sure. And I mean, the higher up you get, the more that you see that. And, you know, I don't think it's any big secret that a lot of these players are, you know, seeing that kind of compensation. And that's why I was curious if you went through that too. And, you know, obviously you played at Clemson, you went through some NCAA tournaments, but you spent some time with the Nuggets, if I'm not mistaken, and at the professional level and a little bit overseas. Yep. Can you kind of talk about how you ended up figuring out when it was the right time to leave professional basketball and jump into, you know, the sneaker industry with Nike? Like, how'd you end up there and what was your role at Nike?
Yeah. So your body tells you when it's time, right? So I spent a hot cup of coffee with the Denver Nuggets and then ended up playing in the CBA for a little while. And then I went to Europe and stayed in Europe for a few years and then, came back and played in the it was called the D League at the time. It was the first year it existed. It was actually the inaugural season and I played, the team was in my hometown, it was in Greenville. So I came back home, as my last hoorah, cause my body was telling me to quit. I'd had four knee operations by that time. I was having to get these cortisone shots in the base of my neck because my neck and my shoulder and arms were going numb just from years of wear and tear and bumping and banging. And, you know, again, your body is starting to talk to you as you get older. And so I knew that was kind of my last year of playing. And I actually had an offer to go to South America to play for more money, but my body was beat up. I didn't necessarily want to go that far away from home again and living in a foreign country and going through the challenges of doing that again versus staying at home, being in my comfort zone. And so I decided to stay home and play in Greenville. Unfortunately enough, we won a championship that year, have some lifelong friends off of those teams. And so I decided that was it. Now, again, I did not have any clear direction in terms of where my post-basketball career was going to take me, right? So I was kind of in limbo. And what I did is I started calling everybody that had had a hand in helping me achieve my basketball dreams, right? I called my old coaches, old trainers, guys who'd invited me to camp. So I was just kind of doing my thank you tour, right? And so I'm just calling everybody, hey man, I appreciate you, you know, taking the journey with me and helping me along the way. And you didn't have to. This wasn't for money, it was because you wanted to see a young kid from South Carolina, you know, accomplish a dream, a goal. And so during those calls, I called a guy who I had met through my cousin, and he was over high school basketball at Nike and had just moved into the pro division. And he asked me, would I be interested? And I said, no, because I don't want to sell shoes. Because again, what you don't, as your statement earlier, what you don't know, you don't know. And I had no idea Nike did anything but sell shoes, right? And so I was ignorant of the monolith of a business that the footwear industry is. And it's not just footwear. It's footwear, it's apparel, it's accessories, and it's equipment. And so, again, but not understanding the business model, the business of sport, right? Because I'd just been a player. And so I said no initially, and he said, well, why don't we do this? Why don't we make you a consultant for a year? And if you don't like it, we shake hands and part way. And if you like it, we talk about something more permanent. And I said, okay, well, I didn't have any other options at the time because I didn't know what I was going to do. And so I decided to take the consultant opportunity, and that year turned into a 12-13 year run inside of the Nike corporate structure. While there, I started as a consultant, as I just mentioned. I moved into a rep role. Then I went to a manager role and then ended up being a director. And I was the director of the EYBL, one of the guys that kind of helped launch it, get it off the ground. I didn't create it, but I was one of the guys who helped launch it in its current form. And so we had some major accomplishments in terms of what we did. We changed the shot clock before the NCAA did. We changed the shot clock from down to 30 seconds before the NCAA moved their shot clock. Because when I played, I think we had 40 or 45 seconds. So we moved the shot clock. We wanted kids to have a truer sense of pace and speed in terms of speeding the game up and understanding that as they elevated levels, making decisions in a rapid manner was going to improve their ability, right? Improve their IQ, improve their vision, improve their thought process. So we wanted to make sure we were making rules to help them. And we changed some of the rules as it related to recruiting kids outside of your state. So we did some innovative things internally and proud of the things that we did while I was there. I'll backtrack a little bit. That's how I ended. That's where I finished my run at Nike. Before that, I was actually negotiating contracts for NBA players. Okay. And so I went from the pro side of negotiating contracts for guys coming out of college who we wanted to endorse, to jumping into the grassroots section as a director. So I was a manager on the NBA side, became a director on the grassroots side. So it was a step down in terms of basketball level, but a step up in corporately.
Gotcha. So you're very, obviously very connected, you know, like you said, with grassroots, with the EYBL and, you know, Nike sneaker industry. So what I want to know is, how does that play factor with college basketball and recruits? And, you know, as a rep, I'm just, correct me if I'm wrong, as a rep, you are able to build connections with players and basically encourage them to wear Nike. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's a little, yes. And in a nutshell, and it's a little deeper than that, because there's a business surrounding the relationship, right? So typically these high profile high schools have some kind of footwear and apparel deal. These kids that are top 50, top 100 kids, most of their schools, these schools that these kids attend have an apparel deal. So that's an initial touch point from a school perspective. But remember now, because you're not an agent and you're not a registered agent, there's contact being made with these kids as young as 12, 13 years old, because you see the talent. And you want to kind of make a mental note of and track and chart how these kids develop over the next 3, 4, 5 years, right? And so you make an initial touch point, you meet mom and dad, mom or dad, you meet grandparents, you meet anybody in that kid's or influential circle to start the rapport. And then there becomes a, hey, does mom need a sweatsuit? Do you need some shoes? And so it becomes this trade of building a rapport, and I'm supplying your family with product. And it's called seeding, right? And so it's supposed to be an improper benefit, but it's done every day at the shoe company level. That's what you do. And you mask that by these high school relationships, right? So you have a deal with the school or a particular kid, but when he comes to camp, he gets new gobs of stuff, and it's necessary for him to play in. Or you send stuff to his mom, but it's for him because he can't receive it, you know. And that's how the game is played. But that's how shoe companies get the leg up in terms of. But that's the job. And so people will say, "Well, you're breaking the rule." Well, okay. Well, do I break the rules or do I do my job? And so, because if I don't do my job, and that young man or young woman. Because the women's basketball business is big as well, right? So if that young man or young woman ends up going to my competitor because I didn't do my job, I don't have a job. And right. So it's an interesting dynamic. But then that even flows into where they go to college, because now you've built a rapport and a relationship with them, and you work for the company, and you want that young man or young woman to go to one of your sponsored colleges or universities, because there's now $100 million relationship between your particular school and the footwear and apparel company. And if that young man or young woman is good enough to become a pro, now I have a history with this particular young man or young woman and their family. So it's very difficult for anybody else to get in and get involved unless it just becomes a money play. But if you've been with me for 5, 6, 7 years, you know who I am. We've been to dinner. I've been at your house. And now all of a sudden it comes down to us getting something done. It's a little easier for me to get it done. And that's how the game is played.
Right. And that was going to be my next question, is if, you know, they're wearing Nike, like if you are basically either encouraging them or connecting them to coaches for schools that are sponsored by Nike. And so what I want to ask is, where's the line? Like, what makes it illegal recruiting? What makes it legal? And like, did you know at the time what those lines were? Like, can you just kind of explain? I just want our listeners to understand it, if you don't mind.
You know what the rules are for agents, but you're not a registered agent. And you know what the rules are in terms of impermissible benefits. But again, if you don't supply that kid with the hottest, latest stuff, and another company is, you're going to lose that relationship. So are you supposed to do it per their rules? No. Are you supposed to do it per your job? Yes. And again, it's that deniable plausibility that these companies like to play with. They want to tell you to do it because they know they need you to do it. And then if something bad happens, we didn't tell you to do it. We don't know anything about it. And so we had this when I was inside, you know, we had the top 25 or top 50 list of kids, but, you know, they were on a schedule. Like they were going to get something, you know, once a month or once every other, you know, twice a month. Right. And the next tier of kid, in terms of how we viewed them internally, our own internal ranking system. If the top tier kids got something twice a month, that next tier kid got something once a month. That next tier kid got something every other month. That next tier kid got something just when we saw him at camp. Right. And so that's how the hierarchy of talent in terms of the relationship internally at the shoe company work.
It makes sense to me in many different levels, because there's a lot of other businesses that do this stuff. You're basically giving people product to wear for free, and that basically is a walking billboard endorsement in that sense. You know what I mean? So like radio stations do that with t-shirts. Oh, here's a free t-shirt. Wear a t-shirt. And it's basically, they're not paying advertising dollars. People are walking around wearing that t-shirt. Or it's the same thing with shoes. Same thing people are seeing. Oh, what's that? You know, what's that kid wearing? Those are some cool kicks or whatever. And then it's, I understand that. And then it turns out to be this, you know, you build a relationship. So it's kind of weird in a way on how that is deemed illegal. You know, it's kind of bizarre, to be honest with you, because, you know, especially if you're doing what the company's telling you to do, you know, the company should be held at fault also, right?
It's deemed illegal because the system is set up to control kids. Let's cut to the chase and stop the BS around what this is. These are corporate entities that are utilizing talented young men and women as chattel, and they want to control that chattel. And they control them by telling you what you can and can't have, what you can and can't do, where you can and can't go. And the minute you veer from what they tell you you can and can't do, they're going to try to punish you in some way. And what our government is in business with big business and corporations. And the government is going to protect corporations and entities because that's how they make their money. And so it's a business train that not one person is going to eliminate. Now, and so I agree with you. When companies, wash their hands of and throw people to the side, I think people, it's a lesson for anybody in corporate America. And I'm sure I'm not the first person to have dealt with this, right? So you are a disposable asset. And if the minute they find a way to replace you or point the finger at you to save their bonuses at the end of the year, they're going to do so.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, it's like same thing with age, same thing with salary. That guy's making too much money. We'll bring this girl gal in. That'll work for half of that. Or this guy's or girl's getting too old. We'll bring in the younger person because of the benefits that could, in terms of cost cutting and things like that, for sure.
And unfortunately, because again, man, I have so many stories about young men and young women who've gotten hurt. I was one of them, right? These schools don't take care of these kids. A kid tears his knee up at your school. Okay, you pay for a surgery, but he's going to deal with this injury the rest of his life.
Right.
He's made you a dollar, but the minute his eligibility is up, you're like, hey, man, thank you for your service. Good luck to you. I hope you can walk when you're 45.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
so you talk about kids and again, these are real people with real lives. We talk about some of these young men who have children by the time they get to college. And you're mad at them because somebody bought them a flight home for a funeral. Kid got suspended for getting a flight home to a funeral and couldn't play, was ineligible. What kind of shit is that?
Yeah. You're not wrong, man. And that's why the education part is so important too, right? You have the opportunity to get the education. It's like,
it is, but here's the problem with that. And this is not speaking to all of the young men and young women in colleges and universities, but many of these young men and young women are not equipped to be students at the collegiate level. And they're used for their athletic prowess. And they are placed into majors such as parks and recreations, general education, general studies,
right?
If you look across the landscape of most of these athletes, majors and what they seek to get their degrees in, you'll see these random what kind of majors.
Yeah.
And just so they can keep them eligible to play for that 4 years, four or five now. And the minute that's up, again, man, good luck to you. I hope this Parks and Recreations degree can sustain you for the rest of your life. Because if it can't, man, hey.
You know, you're not wrong in that sense, too. I know when I went to college, there was players I'd see the first day of school, and then I wouldn't see him again in my class. So, it's the education part of that. It's almost like, hey, you don't have to go to even go to class. Don't worry about it. Somebody will take care of that for you. So it's, you bring up a lot of good points. And you ended up leaving Nike to go to Adidas. Why did you leave Nike after 12 plus years? Was just something, a different change of scenery you wanted? Or is there a different role? What were you doing at Adidas?
So, no, I left Nike. There was some, when I left the pro side, and I was again corporately semi forced to take this grassroots job. Yes, it was a step up corporately, but it wasn't something I necessarily wanted to do. I was living in Chicago and was very comfortable and happy living in Chicago, this new job was going to force me to move to Oregon to the corporate headquarters, which I did not want to do. But I was told that if I didn't take the promotion, I'd be passed up for anything else coming down the pipeline. And so I felt kind of forced to do it. And I only took it because I was told if I did the job for 3 years, they put me back in Chicago, back on the NBA side, and keep me at the same level. And that didn't happen. And so I felt lied to. My father was having some health issues at the time, still in South Carolina. I'm in Oregon. My mom was still working, so he was, you know, struggling to have somebody, you know, take care of him or look after him. And so I just felt like I needed to be closer to home. So all of that was kind of going on at the same time. So I actually left Nike and took a year off. Didn't do anything. Just kind of looking after my dad and, again, trying to figure out next steps. And then got a call and said, hey, would you be interested in possibly doing some consulting work for Nike? I mean, for Adidas. And I said, sure. And I was excited about it because, again, when you're a director, you have a ton of corporate responsibilities. You know, I'm filling out folks' time cards. I'm doing their year-end reviews. I'm managing their schedules. I'm playing Dr. Phil to 45 plus travel teams and parents who have expectations of their kids being superstars. It's a heavy job, right? In this role as a consultant, I don't have to deal with any of that. That's somebody at corporate's issue. My job is really to utilize my existing network and relationships and pose questions to you or give you the information as it comes to me. I don't have to be a decision maker. And I was actually excited about that because I was burned out. And so that's actually how it happened.
Gotcha. You have a great reputation throughout the sneaker and college hoops world. How'd you maintain your reputation for so many years in an industry that not everybody trusts?
Yeah, I think for me, because I think one of the things that helped me, there's several things. One is being a player kind of gives you some credibility, right? And not just being a player at a level and being a player past college and having some workouts and some ties and guys that you played with and against are now coaching, you know, so you have this instant camaraderie with some of these guys that you might not have known on a personal level, but you respected each other because you were both competitors. That helps, especially, you know, with parents who may have seen you play. Oh yeah, man, I remember you when, right? Or an uncle who saw you. Oh yeah, I know that dude, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That helped. I think the second thing for me was, man, I always tried to tell folks what it was and what it wasn't. Now that didn't bode well with some folks because some people don't like the hardcore truth. And I am not one to sugarcoat what I say. And I'm gonna try to be tactful in terms of how I say it, but I'm going to say it, right? And so I think the majority of people that I've dealt with in this business, in this industry, have respected that part of it. And so I don't, you know, people have notions of me because of what they read in the media without knowing me, and that's fine. You know, I'm too old to care what people think. But I do know the truth matters, and I do know that telling people or giving people a heads up in terms of what this industry is and how it works is part of what I think my calling has been. And so I'm not going to stop because somebody tries to give me a label or put a label on my back. And again, I went through a process where the truth didn't matter, which was our justice system. Truth was never allowed to be revealed. And so, you know, it's disheartening because that's the profession my father chose. My father was a lawyer and a judge. And we had some not so pleasant conversations because he believes in the justice system. And I don't understand how. Because I'm saying you're watching these folks, excuse my language, but you're watching these folks fuck me. And you're watching them not allow me to put people on the stand to tell the truth. And you're only getting one side of the story. And so it's disheartening as a black man in this country that there's no justice for people that look like me under their umbrella. It's really disheartening that we live in a place that allows the wealthy to do what you don't allow the downtrodden to do.
Right. And, you know, obviously you spent a lot of time in the sneaker industry and it sounds like you're very blindsided. You just kind of talked a little bit about your, you know, your experience at the justice system. And I mean, in your own words, I'd like for you to set the table. What exactly happened with the Christian Dawkins and Brian Bone situation? Your own words, like paint that picture of what happened, how you found out, and how when you found out your life is about to change.
Yeah, sure. So I met Christian when he was a business manager, runner kind of guy for one of the most powerful agents at the time, and Andy Miller. And nice young kid, a lot of energy, had a ton of relationships, really smart. And he approached me and said, "Hey, man, I got a kid that's like my nephew, and he hasn't chosen a school yet. Do you think Adidas would help him?" And I said, "I don't know. It's not my money. All I can do is ask the question." Right? So he said, "Well, look, dad is on my ass every day about money and needing money because they want to move to wherever the kid goes to school." And I said, "Again, not my decision. All I can do is pass the information on," which I did. I passed the information on to those that I work for at Adidas. Because, again, I told you I was a consultant. That's my job. My job is to pass the information on and be a soldier. Right. So pass the information on to those that I work for. They wanted to run it by their $160 or $190 million corporate partner in Louisville. They called my manager calls me back and says, "Yes, they want us to help them." Okay, cool. Again, at that point, I think I'm kind of out of it because they said they want to help them. I've not been involved in this with on the Adidas side before, so I don't really know how the process works. I then get a second phone call from my manager saying, "Hey, I need you to submit an invoice." And I said, "Okay, for what?" And he said, "Oh, for the situation with the Bowen kid." And I said, "Okay." So he said, "Yeah, so you just get the payment to Christian and he'll deal with the family." Okay. I did what I was asked to do. And then I have the FBI showing up at my door saying I defrauded the University of Louisville.
Wow. When you say they show up at your door, are you home when this happens? Like, I mean, what was that scene like? I mean, that must've been a pretty blindsiding, traumatizing scene, right? I mean, is your family there? Are you there? Like, what's that picture look like?
My wife and I was home. My wife was pregnant with our son. And I'm laying in the bed. She's up getting dressed for work. And there's somebody banging on the door. And it's like 5:45, 6 o'clock in the morning, you know? And she's like, "Hey, somebody's knocking at the door really hard." And I said, "Okay." So I get up, open the door. But as I'm walking, let me back up. As I'm walking down the stairs in my house, there's a window in my kitchen. And I see guys with guns running behind my window.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, "What in the hell is going on?" So I open the door. And at the door, there's four FBI guys in full tactical gear telling me I'm under arrest. And so my wife was like, "What is going on?" I said, "I have no idea," because he wouldn't tell me why I was under arrest. And I said, "What am I under arrest for?" And he said, "I'll tell you when you get in the car." I said, "No, you have to tell me why I'm under arrest now." And he said, "No, I'll tell you when you're under arrest." I said, "No, you'll tell me why I'm under arrest now." And he said, for money laundering was the first thing out of his mouth. And I said, "Money laundering?" And then he went into this defrauding something, something. And I was like, "Okay." So at that point, I just, you know, let them handcuff me and I got in the car. And again, for me, the process of going to court was like, "Great, cool, let's do it." Because I'm going to put the AD at Louisville. I'm going to put Patino. I'm going to put my managers at Adidas. I'm going to put everybody on the stand. And we're going to have a conversation about what really happened. And when I got to court, they blocked us from subpoenaing the FBI agents who were the ones corrupt. They blocked us from putting Patino on the stand. They blocked us from putting Will Wade on the stand. They blocked us from putting NC State on the stand. They blocked us from putting Bill Self on the stand. They blocked us from any coach, any AD, anything dealing with anything involved in this transaction. We were blocked. So I just literally had to sit there and say, "I defrauded the same school that you got a $190 million relationship with. And I don't even know this kid. I don't know Brian Bowen. I don't know his daddy. Never talk to these people."
Wow. That's insane. I mean, I'm sure your demeanor completely has to change going, how do I even defend myself? Was your dad involved in the case? Did he?
He was. And that's why I said we had some pretty tense moments. Because, again, he's saying the judge can't do this and they can't do that. And I'm watching him do it. And I'm frustrated. I'm fighting mad. And so I'm kind of going at him like, hey, man, what do you mean they can't do it? You're watching them do it.
Yeah.
You know, because he's giving me the rules and he's like, listen, state court is different than federal court. I said, I don't give a fuck what it is. I should be able to tell the truth. I should be able to defend myself. And if I can't put the people on, you're saying I defrauded these people. Okay. How did I defraud the folks that I work for who have a relationship of $190 million? I don't understand how that works. Help me understand. Right. So.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. So it just, again, yes, it was super frustrating. And my dad was involved and I appreciate him. He did everything he could and he was, you know, he was hurt because it's like, this is really jacked up. And I, you know, it disheartened him as well. Right. It changed his views on how the system works. And, you know, but I have come to realize, you know, again, man, I'm not a dude who's throwing around the race card left and right. But when you arrest 9 or 10 black dudes and you let 10 head coaches who make millions of dollars a year and they're white, you let them go, something is wrong with that.
How much money, if you don't mind me asking, how much money did they accuse you of money laundering?
$100,000, $150,000, $125,000, something like that. Wow. But here's the problem with it. And this is what you find out in the whole system. What they do in this whole grand jury stuff is they throw shit against the wall. You know, you can't be a part of the grand jury process. So you can't even defend yourself against the grand jury process, right?
Right.
They get the ability to indict you, and then once they indict you, they throw the shit out that they got the indictment on. So they threw the money laundering shit out. Because money laundering, it has to come from a legal source. Selling shoes is not illegal. So how does it come from a legal source? But that's how they obtain the indictment. But again, you can't address any of this when you get into the courtroom. And so again, I learned a lot about how fucked up the justice system is and how they put people in a corner. And if they want you, then they're going to get you. It doesn't matter the proof or truth. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it is a fucked up system. And you ended up, if I'm not mistaken, serving 5.5 months in federal prison. Is that correct?
I did. That's correct.
So what's your mindset during that time? And what were you thinking was the next step in your life once you got out? Like, were you thinking that you wanted to continue to prove your innocence, sue, or how did you figure out how you wanted to approach this moving forward?
Yeah, I think, well, so part of going through the process was, you know, obviously writing the book. Writing the book Black Market was part of the cathartic process for me in terms of trying to deal with this from an emotional perspective. And really letting some of the truth be viewed and visible through the writing. And then, yeah, I think having platforms such as yourselves, and I'm super appreciative of you guys, allowing me the chance to talk. But part of it is continuing to speak on this. And here's the even more screwed up part. Now, I'm not even sure if you guys are aware, but they overturned the Varsity Blues convictions.
Oh, wow.
They overturned them based on this right to control theory, which is what our entire case was based on. The right for the schools to control. That was the theory. That's why we got convicted. So seemingly in the next couple of years, our convictions will be tossed out. But you've damaged my reputation. You put me in prison because it's these lawyers' way of moving from public sector to private sector. They don't give a fuck about the truth. They want to win. And the judges help them win their cases so that they can move on to better employment opportunities. And they fuck people's lives over in the process.
Yeah. You know, throughout this process, has anyone from Adidas or former coaches, players come to your defense throughout this whole process? Like anybody, you know, speak publicly, you know, on your side? Like, it did you experience that at all?
No, you're not gonna have many guys who are still in the business speak on your behalf, because now their livelihoods are at risk, right? So, and that was part of what, you know, what was frustrating for me, was because they were asking me when they were asking me to wear a wire, they were asking me to set other people up. I'm not doing that. I don't care what you do to me, but I'm not doing that to somebody else. You fuck my life up, okay, but you know, I'm not going to be responsible for fucking up somebody else's life. They got kids too, right? And so I just wasn't comfortable doing that. And so, but again, I also, you know, you realize these guys got livelihoods and they can't come to your defense, because if they do, then they're going to lose their livelihood. Because again, it's a corporate machine. And I had guys tell me that their legal counsels at their university told them if they testified, they would no longer be employed. So if I subpoenaed them, they were going to lose the job.
Right.
I decided not to.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of this is basically all legal now. And, you know, we hear from a lot of our guests how twisted AAU recruitment, the NCAA, sneaker industry, you know, obviously Gene Smith, we've talked about that a lot. Everything that ties in. So my question to you is, how do we change it? Like, what changes need to be made on all levels? Like, from your experience, what needs to be changed?
Let me back up and say it was never illegal. Because if it was illegal, there would have been federal legislation. There hasn't been. So it was never illegal. Because here's the problem with the legal theory. If you're telling me I can't give a kid something because he's a college athlete, then no parent, no aunt, no uncle can give their own child a birthday gift because right. It's an impermissible benefit. So it was never illegal. There's no caps on what you can give somebody, right? And this wasn't done for my personal benefit. Again, I told you, I don't know these folks doing my job. I think that part of what needs to happen is I do think these kids need to unionize. And I do think there should be contractual obligations between these young men and young women in these schools. I think that eliminates the gray area. You want to pay me X amount of dollars from an end? Because here's the problem is you arrest me for my company giving a young man, a young woman to go to a particular school. But now these collectives, it's the same shit. It's the same exact thing. They mask it by saying it's a collective. Okay, their boosters give money to a group. They house it in a fund that the school control, and the school decides who gets the money. What's the fucking difference?
Yeah.
And so I think that contractual obligations would eliminate a lot of the bullshit, right? So, and hold the kids accountable. I'm okay with holding kids accountable, but holding schools accountable too. And in those deals, there needs to be some kind of dialogue for some time frame in terms of helping them with their medical expenses after, if they complete their 4 years there, right? Some of it needs to be, if you don't stay academically eligible, then you have to get this money back. If you don't complete the year or you get into trouble to do some dumb shit, you got to get the money back, right? And if you don't give the money back, you can't ever play anywhere again. Right. Like, hold these kids accountable, but hold these schools accountable as well.
I think that's solid personally, because it's like you're leveling the playing field there. You know what I mean? Right. I think that's super important. It's like I remember going to college, first stepping on the campus, and they got the tables out there with people giving kids credit cards and trying to get them to do all these things where it's like, how do you make those decisions at 18? Right. I mean, it's the same type of concept. They're not, you know, and then you default, or the stupid loans they give people are insane with the interest rates and whatnot. And you're absolutely correct. I mean, holding everybody accountability on the same level playing field is what really should happen.
And the other thing for me that I think would eliminate, because I think the NIL stuff is a Band-Aid on a bullet wound, because not every young man or young woman is receiving NIL monies out of these collectives. But these young men and young women go to practice and bust their ass every day, just like the guys that are the superstars. And truthfully, NIL money, a lot of times, isn't for the superstars. It's for the guys that are most marketable, or the young women that are the most marketable. In rare cases, that happens to be the best play, right? But most of the time, it's the kid that's the most marketable, not necessarily the best player. And so I do think there needs to be some set aside every year that young man or young woman competes at your school. You've got to put $25,000 in an account for them. So they have a head start on life when they finish, because these young men and young women that are swimming or playing lacrosse or whatever, they're not going pro. But you gave them a scholarship to compete for your school. And the other issue with this is how they allocate the monies. I mean, I have a lot of issues with it. But again, when you take all the football and basketball revenue and your school is surviving off of that and you telling the kid he can't get a sandwich, that's a problem.
That's a big problem. I mean, I know they went through all that stuff with video games, you know, with the college football video games and what they were doing college basketball video games, where they're using the likeness, the numbers, the names, everything, and profiting off those kids. And yet again, the kids don't see a dime of that, but it's, oh, we're paying for your education. Right. Well, that's great and all, but, you know, that doesn't – they're still making a ton of cash off those kids. Leveling the playing field is the key.
That's not an equal trade-off, right? That's not a fair trade-off. You can't make $1 billion at your school and then tell me I can get a $150,000 scholarship over 4 years.
You know, the thing that's kind of interesting about that is, wouldn't it be cool if they did that for all the athletes, where like 5% of the merchandise they sell, or 10% of the merchandise they sell in all the stores, goes into that fund you're talking about?
But that's why you're saying exactly what I'm saying by they need to put some money into a fund, and that's how they do it. Right.
Yeah.
They need to have some kind of thing. It's not just merch. Right. It's everything associated. It's a TV license, TV and TV deals.
Yeah.
The schools sell their logos and license to any and everybody they want to. They can have competing brands use their logo. So the concessions, the parking, I mean, you name it in terms of the revenue streams. I agree with you wholeheartedly. And that's exactly what I'm saying. There needs to be a portion of that is set aside for each of these young men and young women. After each year of completed eligibility, and not just eligibility on the playing field, eligibility in the classroom.
I don't disagree with you whatsoever. I think it's smart, and I think, you know, that would make a humongous difference. And even like the passing all around everybody else, like you said, lacrosse, you know, swimming, tennis, baseball, anything, any sport, because sports are making those universities money, and obviously the bigger ones are making them a ton of the money, but still, it's important. Let me ask you this. Where are you currently with the lawsuit, and what's next for you? Because I know this took a big chunk out of everything for you in terms of, I read somewhere where you haven't been able to work for almost 6 years because of all this.
Yeah, it's definitely been challenging to nobody will hire you, because I'm a convicted felon, right? I got a scarlet letter on my back for doing something for this company that they basically washed their hands of. And so, you know, and that's part of why it's necessary for me to go through the process. Now, again, I pray that the legal system will treat me better than it did the first go round. I can't say that I'm sure how this is going to play out. But I will be in no worse situation than I'm in if I don't at least try.
That's a good point.
Where this goes, I do not know. I've been blessed and fortunate to have a lot of relationships in the space and the industry. And some people are just telling me to hold on, just let some time pass. And too good. You're too good of a person and too well respected in the space, and you know too much about this in the game to not be involved in some capacity. So what that looks like, I have no idea, but I'm prayerful that it happens sooner than later.
Tell our listeners about the book. I would love to know the process about writing and making a book, because I feel like a lot of people don't understand the blood, sweat, and tears, all the stuff you have to go through to actually put a book together from start to finish. So give our listeners an idea of what it's like to write a book and your book personally.
Yeah, certainly a tedious process. I wouldn't use the word grueling at all, but it's definitely tedious, right? And it's certainly you're going back in time. And so some of the things that you are trying to recall, the details of it sometimes get a little murky, right? And so trying to go back and ask questions. And so I leaned on some of my college teammates for some of the stories that I recall, to see if they recalled them in the same way. I leaned on some of my friends to tell stories of, you know, hey, did this happen this way? Was it, you know, and so they get to tell their version of the story, and oh yeah, that's, you know, that kind of thing. But some stuff is so vivid, man. It's just hard to not. It's hard not to remember, right? And so, it's a personal journey. You know, it brings up. You go through those days where you're mad as hell because you're talking about and writing about something that happened in a negative light, and you remember those feelings. And it could have been 20, 30 years ago, but it still brings up those emotions. So it's certainly an emotional process. It's a tedious process. But like I said, it certainly brings some a level of release, you know, because you're getting a chance to express yourself in terms of what you went through. And I think part of the thing that did bother me in going through this in terms, and I stopped reading some of the articles, but having people discredit what you say because somebody has convicted you is tough. And when the truth wasn't allowed to be shown in the courtroom, and now all of a sudden I've got this scarlet letter on my back, and now nothing that I say is credible. That's bothersome. And I had to kind of get through that, right? Because people are tearing me up at, you know, saying really negative and harsh things about me in the media and don't know me. All they're doing is looking at whatever facts they have through the courtroom, but not understanding the other side of the equation. So I was fortunate in that a couple of friends of mine suggested I write a book, and I was really against it because I didn't think anybody wanted to hear this, you know, just another black dude that's going through the legal system and didn't fare well for him. That was my take on it. And it's like, nah, man, you got a story to tell. You need to tell it. Okay, I'm not sure how to tell it because I'm not an author. I'm a college educated man, and I feel like I write very well, but setting stage and scenery and character development and all that's a skill. That's an art form. And so I needed some help. And was fortunate enough to have two guys that were really instrumental in helping me craft the stories. I'm talking, I'm writing, they're writing, and we're putting our heads together about how it should flow. And so big shots to Alejandro and to Cliff, two fantastic writers. Cliff Sims, who wrote a New York Times bestselling book, and to Alejandro Denoy, who wrote The Boys of Dunbar, the book on the best high school basketball team to ever exist. And so those two guys were instrumental in me helping craft the stories and really telling it from and having my voice come through on page. And so blessed and fortunate to be able to go through that process with those guys.
Yeah, it's huge too, right? A lot of people don't realize that, you know, one person just doesn't write a book and having different perspectives and being able to like interview people or just say, hey, how do you remember this going down? And, you know, or how you see it later, right? You know, you know, as you get older, you perceive things differently. You might have a different opinion on certain times in your life or different reflections. So it's, you know, I have a lot of respect for people that write books because I don't think it's an easy thing to do whatsoever. And I think, you know, nowadays it's a great avenue for you to be able to tell your side of the story and have somebody go, you know what, I want to see both sides of the story. I want to read what this gentleman has to say. And I think that's, you know, very powerful, you know, for you to do that. Were you afraid or did you have any legal advice about releasing the book because of the stuff you talked about in it?
There was some internal fights with my publishing company because some of the stories they were afraid of, like, hey, this is the NCAA violation that you're talking about. And I was like, man, fuck the NCAA. And that's part of why I'm writing the book.
Right.
Right. Because I don't care. What are they going to do to me now? Right. I've already gone through the bullshit. And so I'm not afraid to speak on anything in any relationship or anything in terms of how it goes down. You've already attempted to punish me and silence me, but I'm just not that dude. So I'm not going to stop talking about this until the day I close my eyes. So there was some harsh back and forth between their legal team and myself and the guys who helped me kind of craft it. But ultimately, and we left a lot of stuff out because what I didn't want to do was have an encyclopedia.
Right.
I wanted it to be relevant. I wanted it to be matter of fact. I wanted it to be thought provoking. I wanted it to entertain you in terms of making you laugh because there's some really funny stories in there. You know, and it's me being vulnerable in a sense. I'm telling you some of my own idiotic decisions when I got involved in the business, some of the dumb things I did. Right. So I wanted to have all those emotions come through on page.
That's good. It's smart, too. And I'm glad that you got to do that and that you're happy with the results for sure. Now's the time, my friend, to promote. Let's promote what you got going on, what you want the listeners to know about, where to find you, anything you want to add.
Yeah, so I'm pretty easy to find. I can be found at merlecode@gmail.com. The book is called Black Market. It is a HarperCollins Foursquare publication. Thanks to shout out to Matt Carlini and Matt Latimer at Javelin Literary Agents, and to John Glenn at HarperCollins, my editor. They've been fantastic and great. I appreciate the partnership. And so, yeah, if you want to get in touch with me, that's the best way to do it. And I hope you guys go get a chance to read it and love to hear your feedback.
Wonderful. Hey, before we let you go, Mr. Code, Zach, is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, I just want to say thanks so much for your time. Your story definitely needs to be told, and I'm definitely going to be reading your book. I can't wait to read it, and I hope our listeners definitely check it out too. We'll make sure we promote it and everything, but I just want to really thank you for sharing your story, and if you need anything from us down the road, you know, don't even hesitate to ask. We're always here.
No, I appreciate that, and I hope once you guys get a chance to read it, I hope you have a bunch of questions, and I hope you guys will have me back on so we can talk through it.
Yeah, that'd be great. It'd be kind of cool to do. I don't think we've ever done a book review on here, so that'd be kind of cool when we start a little book of the month club. But no, that'd be cool to do for sure, because it'd be very interesting to pick your brain on questions. You don't get to do that with authors, right? You read the book, and that's that. You don't get to ask them a bunch of questions, so that might actually be a cool follow up. Podcast show, so we might take you up on that.
I look forward to hearing from you.
Awesome. Hey, thanks for telling your story, and have a wonderful day.
All right, thanks guys.
Well, that's a ton of stuff. You know, it's always interesting to hear stories, you know, like that, and you know, I don't really think we always get the full story and stuff, so it was really nice for Merrill to come on the show and actually talk about his experiences, talk about more of the inside of what goes on. And, you know, he brought up a lot of great valid points, especially the, you know, putting a fund together for athletes. Cause I know, you know, a lot of my buddies that played, you know, college football, college basketball, there was a lot of rules back then that they had to adhere to where like they couldn't work a job or they only could work a certain amount of hours. And, you know, depending on what kind of financial situation you're coming from, it makes school really hard to get through, you know, especially nowadays where things are so much more expensive too. He's on the right path with a lot of his ideas, and he has solutions where a lot of people don't have solutions. You know, you tell he's thought a lot of that stuff out.
Yeah. And somebody that's gone through as much as what he's gone through, you know, and I'm just so sorry he had to go through what he did, but somebody who's gone through all that can really make a huge difference in fixing the system. Cause he definitely knows, you know, what's good, what's bad about it. So the ideas that he just had to us, I'm sure that's just such a small sample size of what he actually has cooking up in his brain. So, I mean, he definitely could make a huge difference. And I think that a lot of people need to really take him up on, you know, fixing the system, cause it is a broke system. You know, obviously I coach high school basketball. I coach, you know, these AU teams, and, you know, it is a very difficult system on all levels that, you know, you gotta kind of keep your kids grounded from a lot of times.
Yeah, it makes sense. And like I said, just a lot of good points. I know everybody enjoyed this this podcast episode for sure, because I think you learned a lot and there's a lot of questions you can ask yourself. And, you know, we'll have him on again, you know, after we read the book and pick his brain on the book. And I think that'd be cool. And that's maybe something we should start doing more often, you know, with the guests, because a lot of our guests do put out books. And I'm reading through Dan Grunfeld's book right now, which is a really good one. And we had him on a couple episodes ago, and, you know, maybe we get him back on and talk about the book too. It might be something, you know, like a little small segment that maybe the listeners will like. Who knows? Let us know. You know, let you know how to get a hold of us, and you also know how to listen. So thanks everybody that's been listening. We're charting every day still. I know I sound like a broken record saying that, but you know what, without you guys and without, you know, us charting, like, the show doesn't really exist. So we do really appreciate everything, even the word of mouth. Word of mouth is huge. Big shout out to Gene Smith too for putting us in contact with all these great people and these great stories. And, you know, Gene's a big ally to Not My House, and we really appreciate everything he does for us, for sure.
The captain with a big assist, man.
I'm telling you what.
He's dropping us some dimes. So big ups to the captain, Gene Smith.
Yeah, right now Gene Smith is leading the assists. He's the all-time leading assist player for Not In My House now.
Who said he's just a defensive specialist or a tumbler? He's an assist man.
No, he's an assist guy for us for sure, man. We appreciate it. He's the Mark Jackson of our podcast. Yes, I said Mark Jackson because I'm a Knicks fan. You can say Stockton or whoever, but he's the Mark Jackson in my eyes. And he played with Ewing, right? And so did Mark Jackson. So there you go. Another Knicks thing there. Just throwing the Knicks thing at you, just, you know, because I got to. I'm throwing my 2 cents in. Anyway, anything you want to add before we get out of here?
No, just big thanks to Merle Code. And also, he's a fantastic player, by the way. Just, we didn't really get to dive in too much into his career, but what a fantastic point guard he was. So big thanks to Merle Code. Thanks for sharing the story. And also thanks, Gene Smith. Thanks to our listeners. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate all of you.
Absolutely. Everybody, be good to yourself. Be good to each other. Have yourselves a great day. Spread the word. Word of mouth helps the show out. Hope you enjoyed it. Peace.